Hello, everyone. Just a bit of a pre-episode notice, really. This could potentially be a triggering episode for some people. We're going to talk about loss of possessions, loss of a workshop. A couple of us, including our guest, get a little bit emotional a few times. And there is discussions about people who we love disappearing as well. Not in anything horrific, but just wanted to say, you know, forewarned is forearmed. But we hope you enjoy the episode. It's a very powerful thing and a very important topic of conversation and something to bear in mind for all of us in all of our workshops. Anyway, here's the episode. Setting up shop. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Setting Up Shop, the podcast where we hopefully help you go from your small idea and hobby and take it far as you want it to go into the business sphere and selling your things to all of your lovely customers. With me, as always today, are Heidi Jacobs, a potter from America, and Rasmus Lowen, a blacksmith from Norway. And also, this week, for our first time, we have a guest, and I'll do a brief introduction. Our guest today is an ecclesiastical engineer, a sculptor, a craftsman, a creator of table saw tacos, and three times runner-up of the Winter Barbecue Surfing Championships. Please welcome the man we love to blame, Mr. Andy Berkey.
Hi, everybody. What is wrong with you guys inviting me on here? You have a perfectly fine podcast, and now this.
Mm-hmm. We're all about degradation, really.
How are you guys?
You've got to shake things up to try and get some form of reaction, increase numbers every now and then. You know how it goes. So, Andy, you're our first guest. No one necessarily knows who you are, apart from us here in the few small group, because we don't have many followers. But we do have some who are not, shall we say, from our usual close-knit circle of friends, which is lovely, and we're grateful to them all. So if I run a few questions to begin with, and I'm sure Heidi and Raz can kind of chip in with the sidebars every now and then, could you loosely describe for us what it is you actually do?
I'm sorry. Next question, please. I am trained as a carpenter, basically, is my basic function in the world. But that, over the course of the last 40 years, believe it or not, has evolved from, you know, being a carpenter on job sites, building residential homes, evolving into getting into working with the Catholic Church to rebuild, in an American time frame, rebuild historic churches, which for us in my area are, you know, 100 to 125 years old. And my first passion historically has been neo-Gothic works, basically copying what you guys have in the UK and on the continent, but we think is super cool over here. You guys walk by them all day long, and we think they're like the craziest thing ever. Yeah. But in the 70s, a lot of those churches were modernized. Their interiors were modernized to comply with Vatican II, which is sort of a concept of trying to make the Catholic Church a little more
accessible.
Yeah, accessible. And in that, they tore out a lot of beautiful furnishings and stuff that made the interiors of the church what they are. And they kind of, over the course of the next couple of decades, figured out that they had really messed up. And that allowed guys like me to enter the scene and you know, convince them that I knew how to build that stuff, when in reality, I was just guessing, quite frankly, and kind of taught myself how to do neo-Gothic stuff on the fly. So not exactly a planned career path, but very reactionary and sort of just winging it. And that's kind of been my thing.
Okay. So next question then is, who is Seymour Make Better?
Seymour Make Better is a guy that I invented a few years ago, kind of in a semi-depressive state, more to be honest. he's a little cartoon that reminds me that if I'm going to try to make cool stuff, I have to be very adamant that I start at the base layer of creativity. And in my mind, that is concentrating on observation and seeing the world as we know it with fresh eyes every day. And it's a goal, and Seymour kind of came out of that, as he started out as a very simple line drawing, and but he's come to represent the ethos of really not being a Novocaine normie, I call him, you know, of just like stumbling through the world. I think all of us at our base layer, that's what separates us from the normies, is that we return it back out to the world as making cool stuff. Mm. But it's at its base level, I believe that it starts with seeing the world with fresh eyes.
Yeah, that leads very fully into my next question, which is why is creating or making important to you?
Because I don't have a choice. Mm. Quite frankly, I'm happiest when I'm making, and I am not a hazard to society when I'm making. So my brain will take me, if I don't make weird stuff, then I do weird stuff to society. so it's kind of like, I need to sort of temper, I need to try to be cool with normal people. And the best way to do that is to evidence what's in my brain in three-dimensional objects.
Up until that very last section there, I was like, oh, this is sounding very familiar. Up until the bit about if you don't make weird stuff, then you'll do weird stuff in the real world. And now I'm desperately trying to think whether that is actually true for me or not, and I've just not noticed. You know, being very personal, I do feel like one of the main reasons a lot of people at work think I'm really grumpy is because it's like, yeah, because I'm not in my workshop doing what I want to be doing. I'm sat here having to deal with you people, and you're all idiots.
This is recorded.
Yeah, I know. But I'll probably tell them tomorrow.
Yeah.
Because I am the grumpy guy in the corner who will just say what
you own it. I'm surrounded by idiots.
Yeah, it's something like
idiots.
That.
I think, though, Andy, that you managed to very succinctly sum up the madness that is you.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm trying to be honest, yeah. I mean, there's a long time ago I accepted the fact that I'm not normal. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that in a self-deprecating way, but it's just a, you know, I've always been that kid that, you know, kind of had the weird shaped head and, you know, no one was like, oh shoot, I want to hang out with Andy. You know, cause I lived like way out of like where I had to go to a school that was 45 minutes away from where I lived. So I didn't have like, I didn't go over to friends' houses and stuff. I went out in the woods and built forts and, you know, dug around in the dirt and stuff. It's, you know, it was just like, it's always this rando thing. And you just get to the point where that's just feels normal, feels
yeah.
Like you're most comfortable, you know, in that kind of, I mean, I love being around until the maker community drug me, you know, kicking and screaming into the community back in 2015, I think it was. I didn't know that there was people that really were a lot like me. Yeah. And so, but you know, as a kid, you just learn to accept that. I mean, like I've always said, when I was doing carpentry, straight carpentry, you know, I was always seeing and saying things that I was too arty for that community. But then the art community, I didn't have any credentials. So the art community did, I was too tradesy for the art community. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I was in this, to be frank, comfortable spot of, it's very freeing in a weird way to not have to try to fit in. And it was my big hesitation coming into the community was, you know, are they going to want me to be a certain way? But, you know, as whatever I was at the time in my 50s or whatever, I was like, well, what have I got to lose type of deal? And lo and behold, you losers were like, yeah, okay, he's a loser like us. So
yeah, you found your tribe. Your tribe,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Your tribe of misfits.
Yeah, like the Rudolph, the cartoon, yeah. You know, the, yeah.
what the island of misfit toys.
Exactly.
We're
all okay here. We're just a bit mad.
Well, I love when I did get to spend time with you one-on-one, the way that you view the world and the little things that you see that normal people may be neglectful of because they're so focused on, you know, whatever they have straight in front of them. You're looking for like these inspirational details that are around. And I think that's probably one of the things that makes you so good at restoration and building these reliquaries and duplicating some of these fine works of art that these masters have made historically. And you're like, okay, I see it. I see what they're trying to achieve. Now, how do I replicate it with modern tools and how do I make it work? Yeah. And you having that unique view of the world, but also that fearlessness of just being like, I don't know, I'll just figure it out, I think is ingrained in being a maker. I know that it's probably one of the biggest things that, you know, has driven so many people to knock on your door and be like, hey, can we be friends? I know it's why Ben and I were like, yeah, let's get to know Andy. He's a gem.
Yeah, 100%. And for those, if we just take a brief pause there, for those of you at this point who don't know Andy, I would recommend you pause the podcast and go on Instagram and look up Andy_Berkey. That's all lowercase, Andy_Berkey, B-I-R-K-E-Y, and Andy with a Y because he identifies as male. that would give you a little bit of a glimpse that has been heavily sanitized into the brain of Andy Berkey. He is a very keen, and I hesitate to use the word amateur, actually. He's a keen photographer. And there will be some shots on there where you'll kind of look at it and go, okay, like I'd never considered looking at something from that angle before, or something, you know, the depth of focus is focused on the part that most of us would not notice in the background or in the foreground. And it has driven a lot of us to look at things slightly differently or you know, consider things in a different way. There's even a hashtag that goes around on Instagram of Blame Berkey, when those of us in the community kind of find a thing that we wouldn't have noticed before, and it makes us immediately think, oh, Andy would have spotted that like ages ago. And it's either, you know, it's just something different, maybe something arty, maybe it's, you know, something that solved a problem that we've been wrestling with for a little time. So, and that I think will live on for a long, long time. And I hope it does. So before this becomes far too much of a love fest, Andy,
exactly.
Because you must be feeling slightly uncomfortable at this moment in time anyway.
Yeah, I'm a little flushed, to be honest. This isn't fair.
I don't want to bring the tone of it down. But at the same time, we've invited Andy on for this episode with a specific reason. And the reason being is because we are aware as independent creative people, whether or not you're full-time, you're part-time, or you're thinking about it, sometimes things can just happen that you didn't plan for, and they can have a major effect on your business, on your hobby, and a lot of people around the world, and particularly most recently with extreme flooding and things like that in the States and Italy and various all sorts of places, natural disasters and everything else. Andy, unfortunately, had an event happen, which I don't suppose you could argue it was a natural disaster necessarily, but he did have an event happen, which we're going to discuss. And you'll bear with us. There may be occasions where it gets a bit emotional, and so we'll have to pause and we'll have to move on. But we're very grateful that he's willing to come and talk to us about it. And hopefully we can help people avoid or at least plan in case such things happen, as Andy is by no means the only person this has happened to in this community. But so Andy, in your own words, what event happened that was unforeseen, shall we say, for those people who have not experienced this through your stories?
February 1st, 2022, I had been working at my hobby shop here at the house and just really mucking about. And I decided that I needed to dispose of some chemicals. And the first thing I wanted to do was to dry them out, remove the VOCs out of them so that they wouldn't get into the water table, things like that. Long and short of it is at 2:30 in the morning, cops were knocking on my door and there was three fire engines out in front of my house. And my garage shop was fully engulfed in flames and shooting up three stories and putting the house in danger, as well as neighbors' houses. And it was a self-inflicted injury that the fire investigators were like, after we had gone through, they need to figure out if I started it.
Yeah.
In an arson type of mentality. And basically by the end of the interviews, multiple interviews, they kind of closed their notebooks and said, you've probably done this very thing 1,000 times. And I said, absolutely, I have. And he said, I see it multiple times a year, guys that just, have done the same thing. This was the right mixture of chemicals in the right situation. And it took about 10 hours for it to combust, to go from, randomly safe to raging inferno. So it was really shook up. We were sitting in the cop car out in front of our house burning, or our garage. There was a bit of a separation, about 4 or 5 feet. The fireman did an amazing job to contain it. And I live in central Illinois, which is known for being windy, and middle of the winter, it's notorious for being windy. And that night it was dead still. So all of a lot of the heat and a lot of the flames went straight up. If they would have gone one way or the other, there very could have easily been loss of life. And our neighbor's little punter dog woke up before any of us, and woke up my neighbor, and she called the firemen. And it was crazy, man. It was trippy because, of all the things that could have gone wrong, very, very fortunate, but at the same time, just an amazing loss. So, but I'll never forget my wife, Susanna, and Fiona, my dog, and I were sitting in the cop car. And I remember my wife saying, everything that matters is in here. That really helped a lot, so it's very personal space, which I think we'll probably go into more, but it's crazy because it's a brush with, not only was that loss, but a brush with death too. So
yeah
kind of get your attention.
I'm projecting here because I've not really been in through anything quite at that scale, but I can imagine in some ways it could be really easy to lose sight of the fact that, without sounding callous, it's just stuff.
Right.
Like don't get me wrong, there can be a huge amount of emotional attachment to the stuff. And I think a vast majority of us creative people are semi-hoarders and have Absolutely. Our collections of stuff and our little mementos and knickknacks, he says, looking around, even in my office, of things that my wife doesn't understand why I haven't got rid of yet. And yeah, exactly. So for those of you on the audio, Andy was just holding up kind of one of an icon of his videos and stories over the past and things like that. You had several of those, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is this one of the originals that's cleaned up, or is it?
No, these came from the make. I have three of these.
Yeah.
They came from all over the world, from the maker community. They're some oh, wow. kind of some kind of a little piggy bank type thing that I okay. found in a antique store. And I didn't know that they were still a thing, but within days, these started showing up at the shop.
So it's a strange kind of humanoid, looks like a child in a romper suit with no hair, kind of cartoonish face. And it's just the right sort of weird that those of us who know Andy can understand why he would pick it up in a secondhand shop.
I actually walked away from him, and then an hour later had to go back to get him. I couldn't.
Somehow that doesn't surprise me at all.
Exactly. Yeah. So you know, there's this situation where all of that stuff is just gone, and I think particularly, you know, if you've been, if it was a space you worked out of rather than your hobby shop, I can imagine, you know, you being halfway through a job that was to a time limit or whatever, and then all of a sudden it's gone. And if it's just your shop and it's not everyone's area, then you've got customers, or maybe they live in a different area and they're ringing up and going, well, hey, where's this? And you're like, it's going to be a bit delayed, you know, and having to have those kind of conversations.
Exactly.
That can't be easy, and wouldn't be easy for anyone. And I remember certainly you mentioning in the past that that's the sort of place where you would occasionally keep notes and things like that, or maybe prototypes or models or castings and all this kind of stuff from previous jobs that are not replaceable. You can't just go and buy another one.
Yeah. And you know, I call him my pseudo nephew, George, that is basically my nephew. The day after the fire, he had to go to school that day, and his mom brought him over after. And I looked out of the kitchen window and saw him standing, looking into the shop. And he was 13 at the time. he was out there, and he was in tears. And what he said was, "This was my favorite place in the whole world." And so that for me was the emotional part of it. Again, you really should be thinking of it as it's just stuff. And in the big picture, you're absolutely right. But the reality of it is, it's just a very personal space and a place that I played, you know, that's where I played and experimented. And there was tooling that I had picked up over the years that it just can't be replaced. And I've had to say this to the insurance company, that I know the thing you found on the internet that says how much that tool is worth from China or wherever, it's just not the same. It's not the same steel.
Yeah.
It's not the same heft. It's not, they've been pretty darn good actually of believing that narrative. And because it's not, I don't mean to say it's a narrative. It's just the truth. And they've been pretty good at saying, oh, okay, you know, we get it. It's hard to replace that stuff. And because, you know, you spent a lifetime picking it up and making it your own. You know, how many tools do we have in our shops that are not the same as when you pick them up, right?
Oh yeah.
I was watching Heidi the other day on a live stream with just a piece of spring steel, I think, to form the outside of a pot or a mug. And it's like, I was just sitting there looking at it going, even if she hasn't shaped it exactly, the wear of it rubbing against that sand is going to make it far different from what it was a year ago or 2 years ago or 3 years ago. And so that's kind of the weird, like everything feels, at first, everything felt very, very strange in my hands. Even the most common, you know, my hammer. You know, I've had this titanium hammer that I've had for years when they first came out back in 20 years ago. And it just feels like my hammer. And something as simple as that, you know, Raz, I'm sure you can, you know, when you're beating on steel, you have a hammer that you go to, right? Yeah. You know, and it's when that stuff's taken away, it's just a very odd feeling.
Yeah. I've got a bowl gouge, which was my first bowl gouge, and I've got to the point with it now where I'm looking at it and I'm like, I know I've probably still got another 3 to 4 years use out of that before it's too short to be practical, but I'm now scared that I'm going to use it too much so I won't get to use it again. So in this bizarre opposite thing, I've started using others because I've got several, but I've started using others because I don't want my first one to wear out too quickly. Feels unnatural, you know, you're kind of elevating this tool to a point of like, no, but this was the first one. This was the one that I learned with. This is the one where I developed. This was my journey with. And the others are just kind of like ancillary gifts or whatever that happened along the journey. It's fine. I mean, once it is at the point where it can't be used again, I will probably be sad enough to make a little cabinet and like mount it on the wall.
Right.
Because that's now a totem. That's like, you know, that's the thing.
Well, the reality of it is you're pre-mourning that loss.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which that's kind of a cool space to be in, because that means that every time you do use it, it's special and you realize that your time is limited.
Yeah.
That's kind of a cool space to be in, I think.
Also, has just made me think how much I even overthink usage of tools. I overthink far too much. Too many things.
Well, it's very odd, because I think more than we care to admit, or I'll speak for myself. You know, to me, I've always been, an evangelist against, you know, you buy this color, this brand of tool, and that elevates your game. And I've always been, that's absolutely incorrect. The use of them and the familiarity with the use, that's what elevates your game.
Yeah.
But then now when that's all stripped away, I had to rethink that judgmental sort of attitude I feel like I had. Because, if we're going to define ourselves as makers, we cannot separate ourselves from the tools that we have. It doesn't mean you have to have a certain color.
No.
But
it needs certain functionality to meet up with your demands.
Exactly. Exactly.
Can I, if this is too personal, feel free to just pass on the question, Andy. But at any point, were you sat there thinking, I don't know if I want to rebuild this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially at my age, you know, I'm 62 now. And I'm thinking, you know, what do I want to do? What are my options? And
because you could theoretically have rented a space if you still needed one, rather than having it, you know, having a hobby shop at home and all that kind of stuff. I know it wouldn't have been the same, and we'll get onto that in a little bit. But there were alternatives.
Absolutely, but it was like, you know, It's a good question, because, you know, do I want to semi-retire and just do it, you know, hobby stuff here and enjoy that creativity and go a little more into the creative stuff? Because, you know, when you work for clients, you're not in control of everything about a build. And this was a place where I could control. I guess one of the things that was kind of a loss that I never thought about was the loss of control. Because here, if I wanted to sculpt something really bad because I'm a bad sculptor, I could do it and no one has to see it, you know, and that's a beautiful place. I mean, in a way, that's the luxury of hobby, this stuff, right? We want to do things for other people and put stuff out into the world. Yeah. But to have a, a hobby-driven place was something I don't think I gave enough credit to, or that it was as important as it really was.
Yeah, I think I don't know why. And again, it's probably me projecting more than anything else. It was that the thing when you said about what Georgie said when you saw him out there, I can imagine that was quite a big motivating factor for you to say, you know, not so much you don't have a choice, but
there's no choice.
But there is no choice. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And I feel very much I'm dominating the conversation. So you guys, if you do have any questions, please jump in, because it's obviously it's about Andy. Yeah, go ahead, Heidi. Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to mention, like, I think the juxtaposition between being, like Andy talked about, like being a maker and, you know, seeing things different, and the world that you create within your maker space is so much different than if you were a 9-to-5er going into an office and that office burned down. Yeah. Like, you might celebrate that your office burned down because it's taking you away from the things that you really care about. But when you, like, I keep putting myself in this position of like, what happened? What would I do? And a lot of this emotional turmoil that I have about this whole situation is because I'm watching other potters basically dig out in Asheville to try and reclaim some of their work, to be able to see what tools they have left. And they're heartbreakingly sharing their journey of doing that, of like digging out from the rubble. And I think that is probably a testament more than anything to the difference that artists and craftspeople have with their space versus if I were just like a journalist and I had a desk, maybe I would have things within my desk that I cared about, but it wouldn't be the entire environment.
Yeah.
So I long-winded roundabout question, Andy, when you did decide I'm going to rebuild my hobby shop, because it is a mecca for me and my family and Georgie, what were the things that you specifically said, I want to duplicate in that space something that I had in the old space so that it's kind of like harkens back to the old space and still feels like maybe in photographs it wouldn't be so obvious that it's a different space? Like what did you kind of go back to and say, like, this makes it feel like home?
Three things that come to mind straight away. First one was, once we got everything out, just removal of all the debris was months of work to get permits and the contractor who would take it, and just all the rubbish that had to be dealt with. Once we got that all gone, Georgie and I were power washing the concrete slab, and it smelled awful, just smelled of fire. And that was kind of a mini trauma, you know, just every time you walked out there, it was this instant, you know, smell, the revisiting of a chemically type of smell. So I talked to a paint store that was an old friend of mine, and he gave me a sealant that sealed the whole thing, and then said, basically, you know, then we can do all sorts of coatings on this and make it like it never happened. And we were sitting out there, and I don't remember if it was my wife or, but somebody said, hey, you know what? Maybe, what do you think about just leaving it as it is, sealed so it doesn't smell anymore, but still has scorch marks and, you know, wear on it. And at first I was totally against it, but then I thought, I got used to the idea and I really like the idea now because of where I am in town. I had to go the exact same footprint if I wanted to rebuild. So I just really like the idea of not trying to forget what was there before, of keeping that as it were. Now I forget what my other two points were. one of them was The Big Man, which is, you know, a painting that I did, I don't know, 5 or 6 or 7 years ago of the Laughing Buddha, the way he sits. He's painted on the wall, but he's sitting on a bench next to the wall, as it were, and he's 5 feet tall, which is what, 1.5 meters, and it was just, he needed to go back straight away as soon as we could get things on the wall, because the initial one was a reminder to not take things really that seriously, because it just doesn't matter. And I needed that more than ever, so it was a couple of a Saturday and a Sunday. I projected him and put him, back where he belonged, and that helped a lot. And to be honest, in a weird way, I kind of didn't put a lot of time into, okay, this is the space. Let's lay it out, optimal. It's laid out pretty much exactly like the old one was. And I think that harkens back to just that felt. There was no plan when I set up the original. It was just kind of like, oh, you know what? I need some place to, put the chop box, or let's build, So the planning wasn't intentional, but the execution was a little more this time. And it feels as homey as it can. And I think the only thing that makes it feel more at home is just being in there and creating new, more, memories and more off the wall projects and stuff that makes it feel like, yeah, this is my creative space and a place. To me, creative spaces are free spaces, and we're told how to act and how to fit in with society and everything, but none of those rules apply in that space, and I will defend that till my dying day.
I have to say, though, that seeing you painting the big man up on the wall again, that was really cool, really good to see as well. I was sort of like, okay, he's back, and he's there again, kind of.
Yeah. I've had to back off of social media quite a bit over the last 18 months.
Yeah.
And I'm starting to feel it again, and I've gotten so much outreach from, from Janie to, everybody all over the world. It's just been super humbling, and people checking in, hey, are you doing okay? Type of deal, which, to be honest, no, I wasn't. Dang it, I wasn't. But to know that someone out there is going, we're checking in on you. Because, like I've said before, I've always been that little kid who's not afraid to wander off. You got to keep an eye on me, because I'll wander off into the bush and be gone. Not always to my benefit. So,
yeah. Just to let everyone know again, so those who weren't there, Andy mentioned how much of a creative space it was, and free space and everything else. Within the wider scope of people who knew Andy and was aware of the situation, there was also a potential for there to be quite an irreverent sense of humour around the situation, knowing what Andy's sense of humour was like. And a sticker was created with consent, it has to be said. And given that there was a hashtag called Blame Berkey, and I can't remember, I'm sure Andy will tell me who, but there was a guy who created a sticker as kind of a help to raise money for the rebuild. And it's a picture of the character of Seymour Makebetter with flames behind him, and it says hashtag Flame Berkey. And he's holding it on the screen now. So for those of you watching the YouTube of it, and it was just that kind of thing of, some people in this day and age might see that and go, oh, that's really insensitive. But as I stress, it was made with consent. And that's the kind of thing where, those of us around the world who maybe, we don't have excess funds, we were able to donate. And also as Andy, being the nature of the man that he is, wouldn't necessarily accept. However, we could buy a sticker. And we could show our solidarity, and we could kind of show him that we were thinking about him, even in some small way. And for me personally, as we know, this is not the only event like this, and I'm sure that the potters that you mentioned earlier, Heidi, are getting a lot of this kind of experience from the community around them, or at least I hope they are. where there were just suddenly people coming out of the woodwork who were just like, hey, I happen to be on holiday in the area for a week and I can come and help, kind of attitude. Or, we were just swinging by through Illinois. It's only a 4-hour detour off our route to nowhere in particular. And we happen to have like a bootload of tools that you might find handy in the future and all that kind of stuff. That's say that anyone should expect that to happen, but if you build good people in the community around you, then and you know, generally speaking, that what goes around comes around, and whether or not you believe in karma, you know, it doesn't take a great deal of imagination to understand that, you know, we all help each other. We have to, because without getting political, but the governments of our country are not, generally speaking, in any part of Europe, America, or wherever you are generally speaking, not overly good at helping out small businesses, whether that's through a lack of wanting to or a lack of funding or whatever. We'll put that conversation to aside. But community is a big thing. And a lot of us work in isolation, which from a mental health perspective can be horrific, particularly in events like this. There is absolutely no shame in reaching out. And there is absolutely no grandstanding in continuing the story that you're already telling through social media by showing people, hey, this has happened. I may be quiet for a little while, or, you know, for those of you reaching out, I appreciate it, but please don't necessarily expect a response, or however you personally want to deal with it. But the absolute worst thing you can do is just not acknowledge it at all, because everyone wants to help. If you don't want that help, you know, you have the right to refuse, absolutely, but please don't deny people the opportunity to offer it, because you will feel worse for it in the long run.
Couldn't agree more. When Daniel Harju told me that he had started a GoFundMe, I was adamantly opposed to it, but I'll never forget what he said. His look, people want to show that they care.
Yeah.
And then it turned into this thing that was just unbelievable. And it was just huge. The funding was huge, but more than that, just people from, you know, there's people that were tossing in a couple of quid or, you know, all over the spectrum. And man, you just realize that, yeah, you might be that little kid with the big, you know, weird shaped head, but you know, you've got people, and it's freaking unbelievable.
Yeah, I have to say, I'm a little bit disappointed the slide never made it into the refit there, Andy, because I remember seeing the stories about the original designs and Georgie getting very excited about, hey, look, we've got this footprint, but now we can do other things. Like, I think there was a slide, there was a fireman's pole.
Yep.
There were conversations about a ball pit. There was a
rooftop pool.
Rooftop pool.
Lap pool. Yep. We had that going on. We had to pare those down a little bit, you know, budgetary concerns. But yeah, it was fun. Georgie at one point had drawn up plans for the fireman's pole and the ball pit. And I tell you what, if we could have pulled it off, it would have just been way too much.
I think in some ways, though, it's almost like a cathartic artistic exercise, isn't it? If you think about that whole thing of when people say, oh, I'm stuck for inspiration, well, here's an extreme one then. Imagine you've just lost your entire workshop and you've got to rebuild it in exactly the same space. You know, that's your limitation. Now what would you do? How would you rebuild? What materials are you going to use that's different? What is it even going to be the same medium that you're working in? What would you change? What would you do differently? And but sit down and genuinely think about that first and say, like, you know, whether it's through result of some form of fire, however that's started, you know, or a natural disaster or whatever, but you're back in that spot. And that's can be a difficult place. As Andy said earlier, you know, he was considering age, he was considering a whole manner of things that I can't even begin to imagine. But at the same time, you working there on your lonesome and keeping everyone out, It's a space that a lot of people will welcome like-minded people in and create together, or simply just hang out there with your family, who are not blood relatives a lot of the time, but the ones, like you said earlier, who you've found your tribe, and you can spend that time together. And that's got to be an important thing for all of us, I'd imagine. And I think from what you were saying in the pre-chat, Andy, that was a major contribution to yourself, wanting to get that space back as soon as possible.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, that family came through in a big way in the rebuild. We did rebuild it ourselves from, you know, framing the walls to the roof to make it affordable, and which allowed us to, you know, upgrade the heating and cooling, the lighting, insulation. But, you know, to earn all that, you know, it was definitely a group effort. And again, you know, just massive amount of gratitude for that. And, you know, kind of the antidote to all of the feelings of loss and remorse is gratitude. The fact that it's a better space now, and it will become, I'm in the process of personalizing it even today. Mm. So, and I think this goes back to the potters, you know, in Asheville and hurricane stricken areas. You know, every maker in that world, there's no pill that makes it all right. It just doesn't exist. The reality is we know how to work, and work is what makes it. I feel like people want to separate work and art, and I absolutely refuse to believe that. We make really cool art by working our butts off. And it sort of relates the same way. The process of healing is the process of work. It doesn't come easy, but it's not insurmountable. You just take baby steps. That's it. There's no magic elixir that you drink and you're good to go. That happens in Disney films, but not in our world.
Yeah. I think it's one of those things that we keep going back to, and one of the things I'm incredibly bad at doing, and that is actually, you know, setting things to paper, like setting goals and actually saying, right, what are the steps to achieve that goal? Or, you know, several different goals, as the case may be, that all work towards one big one, and go, right, well, today I don't feel like doing this, but I can do this. You know, there's always something you do feel like doing. Like slight step aside from that at the moment, I haven't felt like going to the workshop the last couple of days because I've had quite a few commissions and things recently. So other than doing this, I've been doing admin on the PC, which I'd normally avoid like the plague because it's not creative, but it needs doing, and it's still a step forwards. It's still moving things along. So baby steps, you know, how do you eat the elephant or eat the horse? And it's one bite at a time, and all of those kind of analogies.
We go for whales in Norway.
Yeah, but you don't just eat the whale. You also make them into candles and fuel and like all sorts of other weird, like bone
whales
handles
are really
and
versatile.
Stuff. Like, stop being so overly creative with your analogies, honestly.
Is their analogy just one candle at a time?
Maybe that's a bit too dark, I guess, or less dark because of candles. I'm not sure how that works.
Yeah. How much whale oil does one candle need?
I believe there's something that I'd like to toss out into the community too. Is I think it's super important as sort of a, you know, how would I mentally prepare for something like this? I've always been a big proponent of having a very wide skill set in the making. You know, we all have our specialties that we, you know, key in on, but I think having a super wide pyramid of skill sets has been super beneficial to me. Photography and cooking for me have been really good creative outlets over the past years to kind of keep my head, you know, especially when I did not have that space to work in. You know, translate it right into the kitchen and be baking some bread or whatever. I mean, I love cooking because it involves all five senses, and photography is another for me. It is a high radar type of activity for me that really involves a lot of, if I'm doing it right, I'm almost exhausted by the end of a walk. I mean, not exhausted in a bad way, but, you know, really, there's been an effort. You know, you're like almost breathing hard, you know, like you've been out on exercise, but only in a creative mindset.
I can always remember listening in on a podcast with you in it probably 7 or 8 years ago now. And this is something that stuck with me. Anytime I'm cooking and I'm unsure what I'm doing, and that was you saying bacon is the band-aid of all cooking. Like just like, if you're not sure, just put some bacon in it. Bacon's going to make it better. Just put some bacon in it, and there's a good chance that that will fall. And it that genuinely has become a thing where I sit there and I sort of think, oh, I'm not sure what I want to do. Is, you know, what kind of carbs are going to go with this or whatever? And it's like, well, let's just start with bacon as a base and work from there out. And it might just be that you just have a fried breakfast for dinner. And that's absolutely fine. Other times it will become a carbonara. It's just, you know, you start with one base ingredient and go from there. And that for me is definitely stuck with me from, you know, will do forever, I think. It's like, you know, Berkey's bacon and Band-Aids, right? Okay, let's slap that on to begin with and
do see it. How we go from it. Can't go wrong. Can't go wrong.
I don't think there's anything that we should really go down the road now before it, otherwise it will start getting into really specific things. Heidi or Az, did you have anything else in particular that you wanted to bring to this conversation?
It's really difficult to prepare for any specific catastrophe like this. But then again, there's a lot of rule of thumb, I think, that's kind of handy. One of them that my dad mentioned on early was like, walk through the whole space that you want insured and just film, just do a big overview, open drawers, all of that. Just have something that actually shoves the content of it, because then the insurance company has something to work from when they're going to repay you.
Absolutely.
I don't know if that's something you can attest to, if there's other things in that style of things that showed up to you that you did or didn't do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if I were to throw something out to everybody, would be once every 6 months, put it in your Google Calendar, or once a year, probably even, get your phone out and do a walk around your creative space and just document your stuff. Because for me, after an event like this, there's a bit of sort of concussion style trauma that you're trying to deal with, of you just can't think straight. And I'll never forget a day or two after the fire, Georgie's dad came over and he had a couple of hazmat suits and respirators and said, we're going out there and we're going to dig through that stinking pile of rubbish and we're going to document it. So we took a voice recorder and spent a week. He took the rest of the week off and we spent the week out there going through square foot by square foot and saying, what was that? What was that? You know, what was this? What do you think this melted thing was? You know, and it was so helpful, but it was hard to do because you're just not thinking right.
Yeah.
So I think anything that you can do to do a small step to document what you have, because the reality of it is we don't want anything that wasn't ours. We just, if we're paying for insurance, you know, we want to replace stuff.
Yeah.
And so that's huge. I've got the other steps that I've taken in retro that I wish I would have taken was I bought off of Amazon, I bought 6 fire alarms that are interconnected to each other. So when one goes off, everything goes off. And 2 of those are now, you know, out in the shop. That gave us a lot of, you know, reassurance that that this wouldn't happen again. And quite frankly, you know, I've always been not the best at paying attention to how chemicals react to each other. And so in my case for this fire, you know, I pay a heck of a lot more attention to being safe around chemicals and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I mean, I just think more than anything, it's the feeling that, you know, I've gotten away with being kind of cavalier about safety stuff for decades. So I'm pretty much good to go. And to be as suspicious of yourself as you are with our work, you know, of being, we're so detail oriented in our work, our what we make, just apply that in small doses to your space and you can't go wrong.
It's the struggle of the stuff that you find boring, isn't it?
It is.
That's what it is. It's like, well, this is just that's just a tool thing, and it's like, I know that, but this is more fun. It's like, no, it's not about being fun. It's about just being able to walk into this workshop whenever you want to, because it's still there.
Right.
But this is obviously leaning more towards away from the natural hazards that may or may not happen, or the acts of God, as the insurance company would like to call them.
Right.
But also as well, finding a company that's actually willing to insure your space and actually doing it. Or like, you know, my shop is at my home currently, and it's a shop for a hobby. So is that technically insured, you know, or is it more of a case of, is it contents insurance and they only insure the expensive stuff? And in my case, I've got a wood-burning stove in the middle of my woodworking shop. So, you know, how is that going to affect the insurance and all of that kind of thing? So definitely considerations that need to be there. And I've gone out of my way. There's a carbon monoxide alarm. There is a smoke alarm with a 10-year battery, with the date of the battery expiry written on the smoke alarm in big black marker pen and programmed into my calendar. There are fire extinguishers at either end of the workshop. There's a fire blanket in there in case of I'm with someone else, you know, all of which sounds great. But at the moment, none of those precautions are hardwired into the house. And that workshop is a separate space. So I could well be a person at 2:30 in the morning. All my chemicals are stored in a metal safety cabinet. You know, all of that kind of stuff is there. But that doesn't mean that I can afford to be complacent, because if an electrical fire starts and it's at 2 a.m, you know, those noises and everything won't help me when I'm upstairs at the back of the house asleep, because I won't hear it. So yeah. The next step for me would be to have, like you've done, Andy, right, we need alarms that are linked, and the ones that they link to are the ones in the house, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, there's a difference between being cautious and kind of overly protective or whatever you want to call it. And I mean, the same way I've got security camera in there and all that kind of stuff. Because that's the other thing to be aware of. You know, those of us who have got vans that we drive around, don't leave tools in the back of your van. It doesn't matter how nice a neighborhood you are in, you know, or whether or not you're like, oh, well, they're not power tools. The people trying to break in don't know they're not power tools. They're still going to break your van. They're still going to cause damage to try and find something that they can steal. You know, I mean, in Rasmus's case, it's not so much of a problem because he could leave his back doors wide open and no one's going to pick up an anvil and just walk off with it. It's absolutely fine.
It's almost like if you can, you kind of deserve it.
Yeah.
Although that being said, are in Norway. There is a higher than average output of guys able to just pick up an anvil and walk off with it. So, you know,
maybe there's that.
They just do it for hobby. Yeah, they just walk down the street.
Yeah. Absolutely. Andy, it's been absolutely lovely chatting to you. And thank you for sharing with us. And I hope it wasn't too painful.
Have we already gone an hour?
Roughly. Yeah. Holy smoke. Yeah, in those 2 minutes. Yeah.
Jeez. Yeah. Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to just sort of talk without being afraid of judgment. You know, it's recoverable, but it's a trauma.
Yeah.
Quite. I mean, flat out, and, you know, maybe as a big He-Man guy, you're not supposed to say that, but I call rubbish on that.
Yeah.
This one hurt. There's no doubt about it. And I feel terrible for the people that have hurricane. I mean, it's very funny because you do all this self-talk of, for me, it was kind of beating myself up for being so stupid to do the thing that I did. But then you kind of realize that that's just a way of trying to cope with it. And, you know, and like you say, acts of God are cruel in their own way because they're so random. You know, you can kind of go down the, I didn't deserve this route. That's natural and easy and not right either. But it's a loss, very much like losing, you know, a family member or something like that. You know, for me, it was the place where I dealt with, you know, losing family members, you know, a place where I felt the safest. I don't feel like we can, being who we are, we can't overstress the importance of those spaces and protect them. I guess that's take the small steps to protect them. Yeah. And that way, if you do lose them, you're in a little better place.
Yeah, absolutely.
If I may ask, Andy, are you okay now? Or is it one of those incremental things of like continuously better kind of?
No, it's not continuously better. It's a roller coaster. Am I getting better? Yes, absolutely. Mm. But no, you know, yesterday I came home from work and basically collapsed. Could have done anything. I had physically, I had plenty of energy, but I just couldn't deal with it. Mm. You know, this morning I woke up ready to go. So, you know, it's again, like a loss, you know, of humans. A friend of mine once told me after I lost a parent that you don't get over it, you get used to it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a very fine line between pushing yourself and caring for yourself, which is kind of a trip because it's not a straight line. Am I okay? No, definitely not. Yeah. Am I getting okay? Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
That's the important part.
I think one of the things I've witnessed and possibly even been guilty of is when we do suffer something in our lives that is on a level traumatic, is it's very easy to think that we're okay because we've thrown ourselves into work and then possibly another hobby. Maybe you've gone to the gym or gone running or anything that just occupies your body so much that you're too exhausted to be able to consider whatever it was that you're trying to avoid. And it's very easy to say to yourself, oh, well, I'm being healthy because I'm working out and I'm creating and, you know, so I'm okay. I'm all right. And it's like, no, you're not. You're avoiding. You're avoiding all of the pain and you're not dealing with any of it. And the concept of going to therapy, certainly as a male, is a difficult one to agree with. I agree with it wholeheartedly. I still haven't done it. I went and saw one once, very quickly realized after the first session they weren't the right one for me, and then have come up with all manner of excuses for why I haven't, you know, either I can't afford to, or I haven't got the time, or I haven't found the right therapist, or I haven't done, you know, there's always the excuses, and it's not a straightforward journey. And if at all this podcast was ever sponsored, this episode would be sponsored by BetterHelp, because every other podcast is also sponsored by BetterHelp at this point. But we're not. But I would strongly recommend, particularly all of us who are lone workers in quite intensive creative arts and things, to at the bare minimum reach out to a friend, even if not for your sake, it might be for theirs, you know, if you haven't spoken to them for a little while, because there is a reason why you're friends and they are lovely people, and it might well be that you just have to listen to someone rant for half an hour or an hour. On the other hand, you might just be able to get a hug, which might have been all that you needed, and you didn't even realize it. So,
I'm going to put a stamp on that one, that there's been there's been a lot of people that have just reached out and said, hey, thought about you, you know, here's a picture of a sunrise. And even if you don't, when I couldn't respond at that point in time, it was incredible support, you know, that you just go, yeah, you don't know what you did right there. So don't hesitate to do that because we're all fighting battles, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Some of us might even get to the point of winning one day.
So,
but as always, if you want to get hold of us, you can reach out via email to info@settingupshop, shop spelled S-H-O-P-P-E, info@settingupshop.com. If you want to get hold of us individually, you can reach me at Bevelwood UK. Heidi is at Whitehall Pottery. Erasmus is at Erasmus Lowen. And Andy, as before, is Andy_Berkey. Please do give him a check out. Give him a follow. You won't regret it. Doesn't matter how often or rare he posts. There's a gem of something there throughout all of it. And look back through his feed and you'll see all sorts of weird things, which is the reason why we like you, Andy. So thank you, everyone.
I'm and we'll speak again. Thanks, guys. This was great for me.
Yeah.
Same. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, man. Bye-bye.